Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk about Cirque du Soleil's Paramore. Theater for a New Audience's production of The Doll's House, Himself and Nora at Minetta Lane, An Act of God with Sean Hayes, Davy Gervais' Bond and Beyond, and West Side Story at Paper Mill Playhouse. We also discuss featured actor and actress in a play and musical for the Tony nominations. Please stay tuned. Never cease.
I didn't like her. Didn't like her. I couldn't stand her. Couldn't stand her. I wouldn't have her. I never knew her. But now I do. And I could. And I would. And I know. She loves me. And to my amazement, I love it. Knowing that she loves me. She loves me, true, she doesn't show it. How could she, when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, bah! Now today she likes me, bah! And tomorrow,
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, June 5th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantiere. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears to talk in Broadway, everything Sondheim and Broadway stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Tonight is the Drama Desk, isn't it?
Yep.
So, are you got all your tuxes all lined up and getting ready to go to the big event in this blistering humidity and possible downpour?
Yeah, right. It's supposed to rain very much today. It's not Texas anymore, I'm happy to say. So a suit will suffice. And so, yes, I don't have to sing that song that starts, got to get my old tuxedo pressed. A suit will do. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's always a nice event. And we see people from both Broadway and off-Broadway, and that's what's really nice about it.
It is. It's nice to catch up with everybody at the ceremony. Mm-hmm. The three of us got a chance to go down to 42nd Street's Lyric Theater and see Cirque du Soleil's Paramore. I'm going to take the liberty of jumping in here first.
Sure. And, be my guest.
And say that I'm sorry that Cirque du Soleil is moving away from their mission, because I think that they are in no man's land, like the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, where, you know, nobody should be. They're in between what Cirque does best, which is amazing acrobatical performances, and Broadway's musical theater. They're right in the middle there and not succeeding at either one of them, and which is a tremendous, tremendous shame, because I'm a big fan of Cirque du Soleil, and I've seen a number of their shows here in New York at Radio City and in the Shea Stadium parking lot a few years ago, and a number of shows out in Vegas and around the world. And it's just, it's a travesty what's happening at the Lyric Theater. And it's very confusing to me, because they are selling out and they're in the $1 million club every week in the grosses. And people are jumping up to their feet and giving them standing ovations at the ends of the show. And I can't understand it. Peter, Michael, can you understand what's going on here?
No, you're right, though. This is a hybrid that I would imagine pleases nobody. And I did notice that during the stunts, and that sounds like a negative term. I don't know what acts. What's a good term for the
aerial acrobatics? I don't know.
Fine. Okay. That the audience really responded tremendously, because that's what they came to see.
Yeah.
That's what they expected.
And it was so far into the first act, at the end of the first act.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and the problem is these people obviously know nothing about Broadway musicals, because what they've essentially done is rewrite 42nd Street. And, you know, when 42nd Street happened in 1980, it was fewer than 50 years away from the movie. And the movie was referenced, and you knew that it was the movie on stage, and you accept it in a certain certain way. When a brand new show comes and has this cliched plot about I'm going to make you a star, the director who's so focused on his work, and then there's the songwriter who falls in love with the girl who's going to become a star. Well, you don't need me to go on to tell you what happens, because yes, it does. So it's really degrading to the Broadway musical to see something so retro. But they really believe they've got something new. And dialogue along those, I'm going to make you a star, and I've seen all of your movies, and, you know, we don't need him, we'll be fine without you. You'll never work again. Thank God that In This Town was dropped. I mean, you'll never work again, you know. So
he did almost say that line, didn't he? He almost
I think
said
he
it.
Did say it, didn't he?
He said, it, not in this town.
Right.
The rest of it.
Yeah, you'll never work again. Yeah, all this stuff, you know. So it's such a trite plot. It's so embarrassing to see it up there. The people are fine in doing what they do. But, James, you and I have to part company on Cirque, because there's an arrogance to Cirque that I don't like, and it happens here too, which is really out of place in a musical, because these people who do these acrobatics – look out at the audience and say, aren't I magnificent? Can you believe what you just said?
Oh, yes.
You know,
yeah,
and so
I know what you're saying
here,
exactly. Yeah.
And they're doing it here, you know, and it doesn't work in the confines of a musical in a review. And, of course, for that matter, Cirque has always claimed that their story, that their shows have stories, though they're inscrutable. I mean, if there's not a synopsis in the playbill, you're really in trouble. And they usually put one in. But the thing is that they do have this ego the size of Rhode Island type of attitude about it. And of course, you know, in a sense, they're entitled because they're very good at what they do. And I mean, they are death-defying acts and all that go with that. But, you know, one guy, you may recall, an Asian man, after doing something, looked out at us and pumped his fist, you know, as if to say,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of that, and that just doesn't fit in the confines of a Broadway musical. I mean, they're supposed to be characters. They're supposed to be in the show. They're supposed to be in the moment. That doesn't happen here. So, yes, I would think that word of mouth is going to be terrible on this, because yes, people come to see those stunts. They're accustomed to them. And I mean, I was shocked when I actually saw that they were doing a book musical and one that was so trite. I never expected that. Maybe I didn't read up enough on it, but I couldn't believe what I was seeing. By the way, you know, the scenery, yes, it's very nice, but there is a unit set feeling to it, in the sense there's a staircase that rarely leaves, and you know, they try to obfuscate the fact that it's there when they don't need it to be. So, yeah, I mean, the scenery is very nice and very opulent and all that goes with that. But there's an Art Deco set that's very nice as well. But you know, you don't come away admiring the sets. You know that they have the money. You know they spent it, and it's rather conventional looking scenery. So, I brought a woman who was a big Cirque fan, and I've taken her to, I would say, about 50 shows, and this was the one that she responded to the least. I mean, she wasn't angry. She wasn't pumping her fist, and like the guy on stage was, but you know, she was devastatingly disappointed, because you really expect to see one phenomenal act after the other.
Yeah.
And you know, they don't even fit in well. I mean, you know, that's the problem. People complained about the magic show 40 odd years ago, that the tricks didn't really fit in with the story. This is far more true here. I mean, they just do them. There's also an embarrassing thing at the end where there's a chase scene, and there's involved trampolines. You don't see the trampolines, but people are trying to escape. And the thing is, they could catch the people very easily, because once the guy bounces on the trampoline and goes up to the staging up above, you know, why don't they take him just there? No, because they have to bounce around too, you know. And then it's so embarrassing when they actually, with no attempt to try to keep it from us, two guys drag on a mattress and they put it on the trampoline, so that way it can break the fall and the number's about to be over, so you know they can't bounce forever. So if you put the mattress down, it breaks the bounce. So I'm telling you, dragging on this mattress that looks like it came from across the street at the Hotel Carter is so embarrassing, you know, to see that they make no attempt at there's got to be a better way. And so a really miserable night.
A new low in Broadway shows, and that's just really unfortunate. I've noticed that when I arrived at the Lyric Theater, I can't remember the last show I had seen at the Lyric,
the town. But
what was it?
On the town.
When On the Town was there, did they have menus Velcroed back to the seats so that we can order food from our seats with our cell phones?
Wow, that didn't happen at my seat, by the way.
We had, I'm not sure if they were Velcroed at our seats, but they were like tucked into something. But yeah, I noticed them too.
Wow.
I was appalled. Like, you know, we are becoming more and more theme park at, you know, $150 a ticket. Mm-hmm. And
it's not it's not a Scott Rudin show, that's for sure.
So,
I want to hear what Michael thinks.
Michael, what did you think?
Yeah. Well, for the life of me, I cannot figure out why they chose to go this route. Does anyone know?
Now, I guess they figured we're on Broadway. Let's do a Broadway musical. I can't imagine it's any more complex than that.
Well, you know, there were rumors originally when this was announced that they might actually try to be eligible for Tony Awards and such, but I suppose it wouldn't be till next season anyway. Mm-hmm. So maybe they will. I mean, I guess somebody has to make that decision. I don't know exactly what kind of contract they're on. Does anyone know?
No, but
They have the Lyric, but they also have AGVA listed in the program, and I also noticed that it's not a Playbill program,
right,
which is interesting.
Oh, and on that note, somebody who went during previews said that they didn't get anything like the program that we got, which is actually, it's a larger size.
Very London.
Yeah, but during previews, they got just some kind of a leaflet, and I suppose maybe that's because changes were being made until the last minute.
Yeah.
But just I just think it was a tremendous mistake for them to try to make a musical. And if they were going to, why didn't they get people who know how to make a musical?
Yeah,
heaven's sake. I mean, first of all, not to get into it because one could go on and on, but it was so ridiculous. When it started, it's supposed to be a tale of old Hollywood, as Peter mentioned, very much like 42nd Street. When it started, it seemed like the time period was the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, at one point, the bunch of chorus women came on in hats that are only from the 20s. Then they start doing – the director has this ridiculous idea. He picks up this girl in a nightclub and is going to make her a star. And he's making some kind of movie called Paramore, even though that title has nothing to do with the movie or with the show Paramore. So why they got that title is beyond me. But anyway, and this movie apparently is going to consist of her doing little homages to other famous movies. And so you see her filming these little homage scenes to various other famous films. And at first, you know, some of them are older. But then things like Gone with the Wind and I think maybe It Happened One Night, really old movies. But then you see and they're showing window cards posters of these actual movies. And then it gets to Gone with the Wind, which is 1939. And then it gets to Some Like It Hot. And Cleopatra, which is the
60s. Which is 63, yeah. And that's a problem too. Not just is it a case that they show window cards from Cleopatra in 63, but if the girl's going to be a star, who is she in this movie? I mean, she's not Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, was this an understudy rehearsal that we were watching? It was so bizarre. And the big mistake was really showing that Cleopatra, because there's a big Cleopatra number. Mm-hmm. So showing that. What are they filming?
Well, no, I think he had a line. It was ridiculous, but he said something. The director, played by Jeremy Kushner, said something like, I'm going to do this movie that's an homage to other famous movies. He actually said something like that, which of course makes no sense. But that was the concept. But again, if you're gonna do that, which is ridiculous to begin with, how can you do that in the 30s if for movies that haven't been made for 25 years yet.
Yes, that's my point too. Because it does state the golden age of Hollywood, and we are led to believe that they are way back when, and the plot seems way back when-ish too. So under those circumstances, I was just amazed to see the famous Cleopatra logo with Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and Rex Harrison. Amazed that they
some like it. Some Like It Hot is what, late 50s?
59. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was. I had mentioned my displeasure with this production on Today on Broadway and got some emails and messages about it. And I have to reiterate that I think that everybody on stage is amazingly talented, and I'm a big fan of Jeremy Kushner. But the big winner here might be Bradley Dean, who was supposed to be in this production in that role of the director that Kushner is doing, and he bowed out for quote-unquote creative differences back in April. And so maybe he saw what was happening here, and Jeremy's, you know, got into it and is just making the best of it, because you're like, you know, world famous Cirque du Soleil. You know, absolutely, sure. Anybody's going to sign that contract and take that job. And this was just an abomination. But amazing talent up on stage. The problem here is the direction, the producing, and the
writing.
The writing. You know, I mean, everybody up on stage is, you know, world class. You wouldn't expect them to be in anything but a top notch production. Everybody was.
I do want to mention Ruby Lewis, who plays Indigo, because I think she's gorgeous. She has a phenomenal voice, and her acting was very good too. And actually, my friend said the one positive thing my friend who I brought with me said was, well, you know, they're giving her this build up, and then she comes on, and you expect to say, oh, you know, big deal, but she really basically lived up to the hype, because her voice, you know, and her personality and her looks was really excellent. And I also thought Ryan Vona was very appealing as the songwriter Joey.
Yeah.
But, you know, but going back to Bradley Dean, and of course we'll probably never know if he left of his own volition, or I had heard he was fired, and somebody who the person who said he was fired said someone else said, well, why would they fire him? You know, why would they fire Bradley Dean? And someone said, and actually, you know, who knows if this is true, but it makes sense, that they really don't know what they're doing when it comes to trying to do a show like this.
Yeah.
And as often happens in a case like that, they look for a scapegoat. Mm. Now, why it would have been him, I cannot tell you, but whatever. I suppose that, you know, and I'm sure it would have been nice from his point of view to have the employment, but... But as far as, you know, being in something that's good and would show him off, maybe it was the best.
Gee, this is very interesting to me in terms of scapegoat, because maybe this should be a trivia question, but I think the worst example of scapegoating was in Nick and Nora. Where a very minor performer was fired, and it was hardly the problem with the show. So maybe that should be – it won't be my trivia question, but nevertheless, maybe it should be, especially since Jossie DeGuzman was involved. I don't remember if she was I think she was the one who was fired and somebody else was brought in. But it was such a small role. It was amazing that that's what they were concentrating on. By the way, speaking of that, you mentioned Joey, and the director is called A.J., I don't know if you heard as time went on that AJ's last name was Golden and Joey's last name was Green and she's Indigo. Is this Clue? I mean, it's so bizarre to me. Well, they're very clueless, I'll tell you that. No, it's
by the way, that the mattress thing that Peter mentioned is to me is a sort of a homage or stolen from, as you prefer. Kiss Me, Kate. Tommy Rawl in the Why Can't You Behave number, there's a point where he and Ann Miller are on a roof, and it looks very much like the set in Paramore. And he at one point jumps like into the theoretically where the roof is, but you can't see his feet because of the ledge of the building, and he bounces around for a little bit. So I don't know if for sure that that's where they got him from, but I bet that it was.
Well, Cirque du Soleil is a worldwide brand, and people come to New York, and they might be happy seeing something comfortable like a worldwide brand like Cirque du Soleil, so it might be now and forever.
Why they didn't do it as a review, like with different segments, which is normally what their shows sort of are. I mean, you're right, I guess that they pretend that all their shows have narratives, but they're very free-form narratives. I can only think that yeah, I guess maybe they were trying something new. And maybe they also thought, did they think we would be more invested in the characters?
I think they
because, did. But the characters are, of course, not the ones who are doing the acrobatics. So it's kind of like two different shows.
Yeah, my favorite part is when they have that three-way thing where the three actors end up standing on stage to watch the three acrobatic artists that represent them do the acrobats in front
like
of them.
For ballet, right.
It was like 10 minutes of them standing there and staring, and it was painful. Yeah.
Sure.
Anyway, let's move on to Theater for a New Audience's A Doll's House in Brooklyn. Peter got a chance to see this?
The sooner the better we move on. Yes, indeed. So,
Peter, tell us about A Doll's House.
It's terrific. You may feel that you've seen A Dollhouse a million times. I'll grant you that. But no, this one is really spectacular. For one thing, anybody who's been to Theater for a New Audience, you have certainly seen the wonderful space that's out there in Brooklyn at the Polonsky Center. A beautiful, beautiful facility. But if you go in this time, you're going to actually feel that you've never been there before, because it has cockpit staging this time. I don't know if you know the term. There used to be a little theater on 42nd Street that used to have this. The Kaufman Theater, Marty Kaufman, I think his name was, built a little theater. And it's what it simply is there's no center section. Think of it as a football stadium that you are on each side. I guess I mean a high school football stadium. The giant stadium, of course, has seats all around. But that's where you are. You're on bleachers each side. You're in seats. You're not on boards. I don't want you to think that. But anyway, but this Maggie Lacey playing Nora is so magnificent in going from the flibbertigibbet to the woman who really realizes that her husband doesn't love her in the way that she wants to be loved. So she really is tremendous in being sneaky at first, because she doesn't want him to know that she's eating candy, cookies, and she hides them, and she has no problem with it. She doesn't think she's doing anything wrong. So, to watch her make this journey and calibrate it so wonderfully is truly the reason to go. However, we also have John Douglas Thompson playing her husband, and he's always a marvelous actor, and he doesn't disappoint here. So I really think this is something you should get to. It's in repertory with The Father. I think it's only running this week. But if you think you've seen Dollhouse before, I have a feeling this is going to be the production you like best, because it certainly was of all the many, many, many ones I've seen over the years. And that includes the Janet McTeer one, for which she won the Tony. And there's something nice about this cockpit staging, that you're right on top of the action. You really feel like you're in the house in a way that I haven't felt in other productions of Doll's House. So that's really good. Also, this is an adaptation by Thornton Wilder, and there are slight differences from what you're used to, especially the ending. Now, anybody who knows anything about drama certainly knows the ending of A Doll's House, which even spurred Comden and Green to write a musical. Something happens afterwards, after the famous ending, that brings up a very good point, Dean. I'm not going to give it away, but I will say that I thought it was a terrific idea, because it's something that's occurred, I'm sure, to many people from time to time. So get a surprise there, too, when you go to A Doll's House. But I think Maggie Lacey will be the biggest surprise of all.
Peter, were you previously familiar with this Thornton Wilder adaptation?
I didn't even know he'd ever done one.
Me neither.
Yeah, this came out.
How interesting. I mean, is it good?
Sure. There are little aspects. Every now and then you see something that's different, and you say, oh, all right. He started thinking of what was happening off stage and brought it on stage. Mm-hmm. So there are a few scenes that you've never seen before, a few subtle differences here and there. But even if he hadn't done those little differences, this is worth seeing for this performance.
Is there a new character called Stage Manager? So the Theater for New Audiences website has the closing dates as June 12th, which is next week, as Peter mentions, at Theater for a New Audience in Brooklyn, which is on Ashland Place. And we'll have links to that information in the show notes. Michael got
For those who take subways, I recommend the D train to the Barclay Center, Atlantic Avenue. You're very close to it. Because it's at Ashland Place, a tiny little street, it is true that many people around there don't know what Ashland Place is. But you're better off going, I think, to that. I've gone a few different ways, and I do believe for those who take subways, that's the way to go.
Oh, that's good. Good tip. Thank you. Michael got a chance to see himself and Nora at the Minetta Lane. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Well, I knew that the show had been done before. I seemed to have remembered that it was done at NIMF. Now I read in the press release, himself and Nora, developmental productions of himself and Nora were produced by the Old Globe Theater, Hamilton Stage, and the New York Musical Theater Festival. Additional development work was done with the James Joyce Center in Dublin, Ireland. So this show has been on and been worked on for quite some time. I found a review of the Old Globe production, and it was 2005. Mm-hmm. And that one had Matt Bogart and Kate Schindel as James Joyce and his wife, Nora. The current production has Matt Bogart and Winnie Bashore. And and apparently there has been quite a lot of work, because the review from the Old Globe said that the show started with a scene of James Joyce's birth that included Matt Bogart naked on stage in a fetal position. Now, this production does not start with his birth. It starts with his death, and then it flashes back, and then, of course, flashes forward again. But a friend of mine said, well, you know, does this start with him naked on stage in a birth scene? I said, no. And he said, well, there's a missed opportunity to sell.
Nah.
But no, you're not going to see that. Although there is a lot of sex in the play, not in terms of skin, but the relationship, the courtship between Joyce and his wife and Nora is very very explicit in the way that they are making love on stage, even though they're completely clothed, and also in some of the language, which actually made me blush. Really very, very, very explicit. I won't say anymore. So I guess they tried to sex it up, and apparently James, I don't know how much you all know about James Joyce. I certainly know nothing about him, but apparently he was highly sexualized. I think some people even say he was a sex addict. His most famous novel, Ulysses, among other things, is famous or infamous for the amount of sex in it. And part of the plot of the musical is that it took years for it to be allowed into the United States because of the obscenity laws. I've never read it. Someone who I was speaking to who was sitting next to me at the show said he's tried to read it once and got, I think he said, about 80 pages, and he had to stop because, again, I don't know how much all our listeners know about Ulysses, but it's written in a very, very many people feel impenetrable kind of language, aside from the obscenity and all that stuff. So this musical is a very small one. In addition to, it's five actors playing multiple roles. Matt and Whitney only play James Joyce and Nora, but then Zachary Prince plays a priest and two other roles. Leon Marie Dobbs plays several roles, and Michael McCormick plays several roles, including Ezra Pound, who appears in one. I thought a lot of it was very interesting and very good. I liked the score overall. I just kind of felt that it kind of started to go on pretty long. It was fairly long. It does have an intermission. It's not a not one of those 90-minute one-act things. It would be curious for me to have seen one of the previous versions, because as I said, it does sound like it changed a lot. I think that both of the that all of the actors, and especially the two leads, Matt and Whitney, do a superb job. Whitney, especially, I've been a fan of for years, so I wasn't surprised. Whitney Bashore, I'm really much less familiar with, and I was again really blown away by her voice and her acting. And also her beauty, so kind of like the Paramore lady. So she's somebody I'm definitely going to be keeping my eye on. And I do think there is a lot of talent in the. It's by the way, it's book, music, and lyrics by Jonathan Brielle. Did I say that?
No. Oh, good.
Yeah, directed by Michael Bush. So. So yes, I would say it's absolutely worthwhile. Just I would say it maybe needs some more work, but it seems like they've been working on it for so long. I imagine maybe it sounds to me like changing the opening, aside from losing the nudity, was a good idea. The idea of him it starts with his death. Apparently he dies and Nora just misses being there. And so she's basically berating him for dying before she got there, even though they had been estranged for or separated for many years. So that I think that was a good way to start it. But it sounds like it's really been worked on for, as I say, at least since 2005. And that's quite a long time ago. And now it's finally just now having a commercial New York production at the Minetta Lane, which, by the way, is a really nice theater. I like it very much in terms of the sight lines and the got a nice big stage, and it's wide, but it feels roomy. It doesn't feel cramped, and it's a wonderful theater.
So it's at the Minetta Lane, as Michael said. It's they have tickets on sale through September 4th. So we'll have links to that in the show notes, and check it out if it's something that might interest you. Peter got a chance to see the new An Act of God with Sean Hayes, which is opening up today. So Peter, tell us about that.
I liked him better than Jim Parsons, because who was fine, by the way. I'm not saying that he wasn't, but Sean Hayes has a less droll demeanor that I think suits the material better. Sean Hayes is playing Sean Hayes, but he's playing Sean Hayes as God. God somehow has channeled himself through Sean Hayes and has made him his messenger. I'm amazed that this show does not get protests from right-wing Christian fundamentalists. It makes no sense to me whatsoever, because God telling us, and I quote, "I'm an asshole," is just beyond me that there aren't people who are outside with the signs condemning it. So if you are a religious person who really has faith in the Bible, this is a good show to stay away from. I don't think it will please you at all. I will not say that David Jabberbaum's points are certainly without merit. Yes, they are. I mean, they really do make you think. I mean, certainly questioning Abraham's and his son Isaac and God saying you got to kill him. Those things are really brought up and really discussed and dissected. And so it's a very thought-provoking show. I have to say I had a feeling that people yesterday were when I saw it were laughing more at Sean Hayes' delivery than they were actually at the material itself. It's clever. I never found it laugh out loud funny. And I noticed as time went on, people weren't laughing as hard or as long. And they certainly didn't laugh at "I'm an asshole," by the way. There was stunned silence at that point, because he may have crossed the line, David Jabberbaum, at that point. So it's only about 80 minutes, which is plenty, really. It's sad that there are two actors buttressing him on the side that have virtually nothing to do. It was one of them is a very talented guy named David Josephberg, who I've seen since his NYU days, you know, and I just feel bad that this is the job he has to take, because he has virtually nothing to do. But Sean, if you like Sean Hayes, he's certainly playing a variation on the character he played in Will and Grace. It is that same sensibility. So So God's a little more gay in this production than he was in Jim Parsons' production, and he's certainly more out there and it really takes on that persona. So if you like Jack and Will and Grace, you are going to like the way he handles the material here. I mean, a lot of people like to see people repeat what they do best, and this is obviously what he does best, and he's certainly doing it fine. But I won't be surprised if he came out saying, you know, I didn't laugh either. I smiled. I appreciated. I understand what David Gerberbaum was going for. He's really testing us in terms of why do we believe what we believe and why is it so important for us to believe these things? Should we really be asking many more questions than we've been asking rather than taking thing at face value? All that's very good. But sense of humor, of course, is so subjective, but we're not in the same orbit when it comes to sense of humor. So I can only hope if you go that you will be.
But Peter, going from memory, do you seem to recall that there was less laughter than with Jim Parsons? Not necessarily from you, but just
No. I'm thinking about that. I think it's pretty much the same. People just love being in the company of a star, and a show like this where you really get him virtually nonstop. I mean, he has like 99 and 44 100% of the dialogue, so they get what they come for. So I think the laughter was just as generous the last time. I just think that Sean Hayes is more suited to this type of thing than Jim Parsons. But, and again, who was wonderful. You know, it's just that this is an example, and there aren't too many of them, really, when you come right down to it, an example of the second person playing the role turning out to be better than the first.
Last time when it was done with Jim Parsons, the other actor was Christopher Fitzgerald, but he's busy now in Waitress. So it's James Gleason. I just want to note that. And I guess they still have the voice of Patrick Page as God.
Oh, is that who it is? Yeah, I didn't notice that. Okay.
And if anybody's got a God voice, it's Patrick Page.
Yes, that's right. Exactly, yes, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. But that is so true what you said, Peter. I mean, I don't know how these religious right groups choose what they target.
I think they're very, very busy these days.
That may very well be it. Yeah.
And I'm not sure that Broadway's, is there a big religious audience in the typical Broadway audience? I don't. Maybe this has eluded them. They haven't known. They don't know about this yet. So Act of God is playing through September 4th as well with Sean Hayes at the Booth Theater. Last time it was at Studio 54. I've noticed it's got about 50% of the producers are different this time than last year, and it was done just a year ago, and maybe this is going to be a recurring theme. Every summer we'll have a new star come in and do that, and I'm looking forward to when Hasselhoff does it.
That's a very good point, that this is a show that opened in the summer the first time around, and here it is again. And yet I don't think it was a summer tourist show, because tourists tend to come from a part of the country that's far more interested in religion than us big sinners here in New York, as Ted Cruz used to say, you know, our New York values, you know, I mean, and how terrible we were. So under those circumstances, it's kind of surprising to me that it's a summer show. But of course, what does sell it is the fact that those people who are tourists certainly watch TV and certainly know who these people are. So
These are television stars who are off for the summer from their shooting regiment.
Yeah.
On a somewhat related note, I was walking down Ninth Avenue the other day, and there was a couple that seemed like they needed directions. And so I gave them directions, and they were really very nice. And I was going to see – I think I was going to see Paramore. And they said, oh, we're going to see a show tonight. And I said, what? And they said, Fully Committed. And they were going specifically because of Jesse Tyler Ferguson, although the guy in the couple couldn't even think of his name. So just for whatever that's worth, I said, well, I said, you're going to love it. He's great in it, and you're going to have a great time. So I suspect that in cases like that, that many people choose specifically for that reason and don't even do a lot or any research into what they're actually going to be seeing.
So a man and woman couple, I would bet 9 out of 10 times, though, the woman bought the tickets.
Sure.
Oh, so yeah. She knows who Jesse Tyler Ferguson is.
Yeah, but he did yeah. seem to be a fan of Modern Family. Yeah. So I guess he just couldn't think of his name.
Mm-hmm. All right, Michael, you got over to NJ Pack to see Debbie Gravitt's Gravitt's Bond and Beyond. And we spoke to Debbie a few months back before she was coming in to do that. So tell us, how was it?
Yeah, I guess it was. Was it that long ago? It was several weeks ago. Anyway, it was a wonderful concert with the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra, conducted by I guess a guest conductor. I think his name is Michael Krzyzewski. I think that's how he pronounced it. And he, aside from conducting really well, was really quite humorous in his. In his banter with the audience. He even did a multiple choice test of our knowledge of Bond, but it was all jokes, and the audience just loved it. He was really delightful, and Debbie is always great. Her voice is as phenomenal as ever. She looks amazing. And one thing that happened was during intermission, I was walking up the aisle, and these two random audience members were behind me, and one of them turned to the other one, and he said, this was the greatest compliment. I should have told Debbie when I spoke with her afterwards, but I forgot. He said something like, well, you know, you can tell that she's from Broadway because she has that extra vivacity and life and sparkle and personality. And I thought that was so true. Mm-hmm. So perceptive of him to say that, and it was true. Aside from her voice, she just relates to the audience so well, and everybody loved her. And it was a great concert. To hear those Bond pieces by several different composers played by a huge orchestra. There's just nothing like it. And it was a lot of the stuff you'd imagine. Debbie sang songs like Goldfinger and Nobody Does It Better. There was also – she did not sing For Your Eyes Only. That was the only one I missed her hearing her sing, because I think she would have done a beautiful job. But the orchestra played it, so it was not neglected. The program was called Bond and Beyond, so it wasn't completely Bond music. They had music from Austin Powers and other, you know, like spoofs and other similar types of movies and TV shows. Debbie came out in full 60s regalia with a wig and sunglasses and sang the theme from the TV series Secret Agent Man. Do you all remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
Secret
Agent Man.
Which I forgot. The conductor said was a British TV series.
Oh.
Did you remember that?
No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then she sang, and here's another theater connection. She sang Sooner or Later from Dick Tracy,
mm-hmm.
which is Sondheim, of course. And I've forgotten had actually won an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that gave Sondheim his O part of his EGOT.
Right, right, right.
I don't know if that was so. Yeah, it was a really great program, and I love that gorgeous, gorgeous hall at NJ Pack. The acoustics are superb, and it's just a wonderful evening all around, and thoroughly delightful. Norm Lewis was. Did that happen yet? Oh, yes, that was a couple of months ago. Norm Lewis was there, and we have David Cassidy coming up if anybody wants to see David Cassidy at NJ Pack.
I love David Cassidy and Blood Brothers way, way back when he did it with Sean.
Yeah,
I was like, I really enjoyed that production when they were both in it. I wasn't a huge fan of the show. That Marilyn Monroe song used to kill me. Over and over and over in Blood Brothers, but I really loved seeing David and Sean in it.
I saw David in Joseph and the Amazing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Yeah. He was very good in that.
He was very good.
Michael, you are correct once again. We spoke to Debbie just a few weeks ago. I looked it up. It was May 1st. It just seems like...
Because
I'm doing so many podcasts that it feels like months ago. All right. So next up, the final review of the morning is Peter got a chance to see West Side Story at Paper Mill, which is opening tonight. So, Peter, tell us, what are the Sharks and the Jets doing in Jersey?
They're doing a good job, by and large. It's a wonderfully slick production. You feel like you're in the theater for 22 minutes. And West Side Story, even though it doesn't have very much of a book, has a lot of music, a lot of great music, needless to say. And music that somehow, I don't know how it happens, but it just doesn't seem dated. I don't think there's ever been more exciting music in a Broadway musical than you get in West Side Story, especially so much of that dance music. So it really is quite wonderful. What's also, there were a couple of things that struck me that never really occurred to me before. One, it's really good to see West Side Story on stage because there's so much talk about we've got to protect our turf, this is our turf, etc. Having it in a small space really makes a big difference. The movie, I mean, even though Manhattan is only 13.7 miles long, the fact is the movie makes Manhattan seem large and big, and it doesn't seem like they're all like rats in a Skinner box. So I think that really is something of an asset of seeing West Side Story on stage, that they do seem to be almost stepping on each other, and you can see where that would happen. Another observation, and I know this is going to sound terrible in the sense that I'm making the comparison with something that was far more serious, but I have to admit that I was reminded of what I've read about The Diary of Anne Frank, the first time it ever had a performance in Germany, and how sobered people were, and they just sat there and they couldn't respond. Even when it ended, they couldn't applaud for the longest time because it really shamed them. And in a way, I felt a minor league version. Please don't think that I'm really equating the two. But a minor league version of that with the Paper Mill audience, which really seemed ashamed every time there was some sort of ethnic slur leveled against the Sharks. There are some lines that aren't in the movie that are really quite friendly. There's one that deals – I don't remember exactly how it went, but it really deals with the fact that Puerto Rican girls are loose women. And it was – stunned silence met these remarks, and it really did seem like they were the audience was shamed by it. Mm-hmm. So Mark Hobie has done an excellent job with two exceptions. The Tony, my God, what a voice! It is so wonderful to hear somebody who is so spectacularly vocally gifted, and that's Matt Doyle. A wonderful, wonderful job.
Who, previous to this, has really, as far as I know, not had any role remotely as challenging vocally as that. I mean, he was Hugo in Bye
right.
Bye Birdie.
Yeah.
He did Grey Gardens in up at Bay Street. Whenever that was.
When Betty Buckley did it there.
Yes, yeah, yeah. With Rachel York. But even that's not Tony. I mean, you know, so I'm so glad to hear that, Peter.
Glorious voice. Just wow. Tremendous. Also, I have to say that Maria is extra special in this production, too. She's Belinda Allen, because she's far more feisty as the show goes on. Mm-hmm. And it really sets up very much better the I Have a Love sequence. And also, it sets up better her explosion at the end when she castigates both the Sharks and the Jets for what they've done. So that's very effective. Now, the two missteps to me, that one is just interpretation, but I really did feel that the actor playing Chino was not nearly as upset as he should be when he comes in to tell Maria that not only has her brother been killed, but her boyfriend has done it. I mean, the way he came in and the way he dealt with it, it was almost as if he was going to say, Maria, there's no hot water in the apartment. I mean, it was no more emotional than that. And I really felt that he really needed desperately to be frightened and out of his mind with wondering how he's going to tell her. And because, I mean, this is one of the strangest double plays in theater history, that not only is it a case where your brother has died, but the person you love has done the killing. I mean, how do you tell anybody that? And I mean, he just didn't seem to have the weight of the world on his shoulders. And I thought that was a problem. The other problem is a hair problem, ironically enough, because I don't think anybody's who desperately wants to be part of the Jets, who really identifies herself as a man, would wear a ponytail. And I think that's a real miscalculation, and I'm surprised that it didn't bother anybody the way it bothered me. So, in fact, she's a little too pert. I mean, she really, it looks like she just came from playing Galinda, you know, so I think that's a real problem, and because she really should be quite a tough cookie, and she doesn't quite have that, and so I think she's been miscast. But otherwise, wow, it really is a terrifically moving production in both levels, that it moves well, and that, of course, you feel bad as you see the events unfold so unnecessarily. Yeah, there is that scene, it's in the movie too, where they want to the Sharks and the Jets are planning their rumble, and the cops come in, and they all sit down, they start pretending they're getting along, they're playing cards, and they're doing all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and you do wonder, why can't this be every day? Why must it be? Let me also point out that William Ragsdale is a terrific Lieutenant Schrank, because Simon Oakland in the movie is annoyed. This guy is really ferocious. He is just up to here with these kids, and I mean, he is not using euphemisms. I mean, and he has a lot of ethnic slurs too, more than are in the movie. So, but he is giving a terrific performance that really is bone chilling. In the way that he doesn't care what he says and who he says it to, and so that's really something. And you know, something occurred to me too. Here's another praise of Sondheim. How many times in the musical theater history have we heard a line repeated in a song? Millions. Yeah, I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. I mean, in Starlight Express, there's a very good joke in a song called Papa's Blues, in which a grizzled old black man sings the first line of the blues always gets sung a second time.
And he sings
the next line of the song, the first line of the blues always gets sung a second time. Well, anyway, nobody has written two lines in a row that are exactly the same, that have more power than in the quintet, when the Jets say, well, they began it, and the Sharks, well, they began it. Because the same line, but the thing is, you know that both of them truly believe that that's the case. They really do believe the other gang is responsible for all the trouble. And we know that it could be either one of them or both that caused the problem. So I think that's really effective. And it's such a simple thing. And so many times the best things in musical theater are the simple things. And this is an example of that, because here's the line simply repeated, and yet it has so much power, because we really do realize that each of them is to blame.
Yes, and there's also those lines of dialogue towards the first time that the I guess it's that same scene where they have their war council, mm-hmm. and they get into that a little bit. It's like, well you jumped me the first day I moved here, and then they start calling each other Spick and Wop and Mick, and mm-hmm. and they almost come to blows, and you just your heart breaks. It's just so sad.
Yeah, really. The thing is, of course, to a degree, West Side Story is still relevant, because there's still a lot of hatred here and there for various ethnic groups. But I may be aggrandizing the show too much, but given the fact that this was such an important component in the baby boomers' life, where every kid saw this movie in 1961, every teenager, it was the date movie, especially since it was a hard ticket, meaning reserved seats, that every guy, no matter who he was, took his girl to see West Side Story, and she would come out in tears, and he would pretend that he didn't have to do that. But yeah, I really believe that it really did help race relations, because so many baby boomers did get to see this property in very glorious form. It's a wonderful movie. You don't need me to tell you that with all its Oscars. But I really do believe it helped. Art does help, I truly believe, anyway. You know, I also got to say, since we're talking about hair, or at least I am, that I was a little concerned about Mikey Winslow's hair. He plays Riff, and it looked two-toned to me, and it looked like he had been to a beauty parlor, you know, and I thought that was a little strange. I don't think these kids can't afford that.
Right.
But I also want to single out Cody Williams, who was one of the sailors in On the Town, I think it was a swing last year, playing Action, and wow, he's pretty ferocious and well, and I hope he gets a chance to play Riff someday, because I really think he'd be extraordinarily good at it. So I know it seems like nobody needs to see another West Side Story. I understand that. I do. You know, it's probably one of the most overexposed properties that we have, but there's a reason for that, because it's so damn good, and it's very nice that with these minor quibbles that I'm telling you, it's a terrific production. The dancing is quite wonderful, and it's going to be one of those shows that if you say all right, I'll go, you know, you're going to have a better time than you think. You're going to come away more in awe.
Mm-hmm. Peter, I know that we're under a time constraint here, but I wanted to get a few points in about West Side Story. I think that it's important to talk about West Side Story again in the context of, we have a major presidential candidate who is saying very racist remarks,
yes,
and this,
yes,
and that might play into why the audience is shocked into silence about this stuff. When
I think you're right.
I wouldn't be surprised, Jim.
You know, whether it's Puerto Ricans or Mexicans or Muslims or anybody else, these are scary times that a West Side Story can show that that we haven't quite gotten over this yet. And the other aspect of it is that in the retrospective, you're talking about the baby boomers who saw West Side Story. My anecdotal experience with West Side Story, and certainly have no data to back this up, is that when West Side Story was done in my high school, all of a sudden everybody on the football team wanted to be in the play.
My buddy Bert Silverberg, who is a teacher in Rhode Island, says it's impossible to get boys to appear in a musical, but if you can tell them they can be a Shark or a Jet, they'll join right in. It's there's something in a way very sad about that too, but nevertheless, whatever it takes to get guys to do it, that's fine, because who knows.
But I know a lot of athletes who their first experience was, you know, auditioning for a West Side Story, and have either continued to do theater or have an appreciation for the theater after their experience in West Side Story.
Yeah, and who knows? Today's baby John, one of the Jets, maybe tomorrow's John Adams. I mean, it could very well be that way, that you get somebody interested and, you know, this is a good thing. And so, yeah, that's very true.
I saw that William Ragsdale is in it. I haven't seen the show yet. I'm going tonight, actually, for the opening. But I'm glad to hear that he's so good as Shrank, but also that'll be fun for the audience, because a lot of them will probably remember him from Herman's Head, the TV show. I mean, maybe he lives in Jersey now. Maybe that's why he's doing it. But whatever, that sounds great. And I will see. I personally don't want to go on. I will see West Side Story whenever and wherever it's done. I spoke about that amazing production, that Carnegie Hall production that was done at the old Foundry in Queens several months ago.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
That was incredible. And my experience is, I don't know what you think, I have never seen a bad production of West Side Story. And I think it's paradoxically because people have so much respect for it and realize how difficult it is that they do not tend to do it if they can't do it right. So I will always go, and I will always be astonished. And I think it will outlive I think it is an immortal piece of musical theater. Somebody quoted Sondheim recently. I'm not sure if it's true, but because secondhand, Sondheim said something about how a musical theater doesn't tend to last because it's ephemeral. And he said something to the supposedly said something to the effect of, I don't know if any of my stuff will last, maybe Gypsy. And I thought, well, I think Gypsy will last, but West Side Story, I think, will last forever. And partly because, unfortunately, it will always be relevant in terms of the bigotry and the hatred, but also because it's just one of the supreme achievements of the human mind and heart.
So Peter's on a hard deadline, so I know that we have to get out of here in just a few minutes. Let's run through this very quickly. Let's not spend a ton of time on this, but I wanted to hear your takes on the Tony Awards featured actor or actress in a play and a musical. So first category is best performance by an actor in a featured role in a play, and we have Reed Birney in The Humans, Bill Camp and Arthur Miller's The Crucible, David Furr in Noises Off, Richard Goulding in King Charles III, Michael Shannon in Long Day's Journey and Tonight. So Peter, what do you think?
I think this is Reed Birney in a walk, partly because it'll be a Lifetime Achievement Award. But here's an actor who's really been around for a long time and has always done wonderful work. I've admired him for decades, literally decades. I first saw him in the 70s. So under those circumstances, I think he's going to have no problem winning that. And also, he's very good in the play. For those who haven't seen him, he plays the father of a family that's having a lot of trouble, and they're meeting at Thanksgiving, and it is not a happy-go-lucky event. It's not like George and Martha and Virginia Woolf. It's not that type of thing. Nobody really gets furious with each other. In fact, there are times when you would think that they would get more furious with each other. So anyway, I do think it's going to be no problem whatsoever for Reed Birney to pick up that award. So, Michael?
Right. Michael, what do you think?
I completely agree for both of those reasons. For the lifetime achievement aspect, Reed has been getting a lot of attention in the past few years. It seems like people have suddenly realized how great he is and what wonderful work he's been doing in several things. So, though I will say that David Furr was so brilliant in Noises Off that he does deserve a Tony also. So maybe he'll get one in another year for another show. But I thought he was absolutely fantastic. Everyone in the category was just fine. But those two I thought were absolutely stellar.
The best performance by an actress in a featured role in a play, Pascal Armand in Eclipsed, Megan Hilty in Noises Off, Jane Houdyshell in The Humans, Andrea Martin in Noises Off, and Michael, maybe you can help me, Sekhan Sembla in Eclipsed. Sembla.
I think so.
And Eclipsed. So, Michael, what do you think about this category?
I think Jane Houdyshell, who is wonderful and is kind of similar to Reed and what I just said, just wonderful work over many seasons. And the play itself has gotten a lot of deserved attention. So maybe this will be her year. Again, everyone else in the category is very worthy, and I did. And again, I loved Megan Hilty. I thought she really made that part her own, and the audience adored her. So, I think Jane.
Peter.
Yes. Interesting. The two you mentioned are the ones that I'm most fond of too in this category. Years ago, back in 2006, when Jane was nominated for Well, most people thought she was going to win then. So I do think that this will be one of the factors in having her win this time. However, this is one of those times when I wish that there were best actress in a play and best actress in a comedy, because Megan Hilty was so magnificent in playing this bimbo who thought she was a great actress. That's what made the performance so interesting, that she really thought she was magnificent. They were so lucky to have her. She had no idea that she stunk. And again, I'm talking about the character now. I'm not talking about Megan Hilty.
Yeah.
So I would have a real tough time here clicking off one of the two, but I do believe it's going to go to Jane.
All right, best performance by an actor in a featured role in a musical, David Diggs in Hamilton, Brandon Victor Dixon in Shuffle Along, Christopher Fitzgerald in Waitress, Jonathan Groff in Hamilton, or Christopher Jackson in Hamilton. Peter, why don't you start us off there?
Yeah, there's a lot of Hamilton, isn't there, in this category? Now, traditionally, they always say that when there are so many people that they cancel each other out, and that's what happens under those circumstances. I don't think it's going to happen this year in this category. Yes, there will be categories that Hamilton will lose as time goes on, but I don't think this is going to be one of those categories where it's going to happen. So I think it's going to go to Davey Diggs, and that's fine with me.
Michael?
Yeah, I think it will go to him also. I again, everyone was great. I loved Jonathan, but I hope it's okay to say this. I think that perhaps people would be maybe somewhat reluctant to vote for the white nominee in this case, because the show is so much about inclusive alternative casting and these roles being played by people of color, although of course I do realize that the whole point of King George III being played by a white person, I completely understand that. But I think Davey Diggs was delightful and incredibly entertaining in the show, and I do remember having a problem with him being behind the beat a little bit in the raps, which just like, you know, a split second, which was a little bit of an issue for me. But other than that, I thought he was great. Chris Jackson, who has worked with Lin-Manuel Miranda before, is another one of my favorites. But I just think partly because of the way the role is not as showy as David's role. So I think that that would give the edge to David.
Well, my feeling about Jonathan Groff has more to do with the fact that he doesn't have that much to do. I mean, he has one of the best songs in the show, no question about that. But he's not on stage very much, so I think that would work against him as well.
All right, the next category and the last one for this morning is best performance by an actress in a featured role in a musical. Danielle Brooks in The Color Purple, Renice Elise Goldsberry in Hamilton, Jane Krakowski in She Loves Me, Jennifer Simard in Disaster, and Adrian Warren in Shuffle Along. So, Peter.
Well, this is a toughie, too. I mean, it's very possible that this will be the Katie Huffman type thing, where in the producers, she got swept along in the tide. And so Miss Goldsberry has an edge there for being in the big hit. So Jane Krakowski has won before, so that may be held slightly against her. Danielle Brooks is marvelous in The Color Purple. We were very happy to give her a Theater World Award, where she gave a magnificent speech, by the way. Who knows? Maybe there'll be an upset here. I think it would be an upset if Jennifer Simard won for Disaster, mostly because, of course, her show is closed. And a lot of people, and that may even include Dodie voters, didn't see it. Adrian Warren, a very nice performance. Again, not that much to do. So I think that will be held against her. So so I'm going to go with Goldsberry in the Hamilton coattails factor.
Michael?
Yeah, I think it will be either Goldsberry or Brooks, and both are deserving. I've really loved Renee Elise Goldsberry for years. She was one of the best memes in Rent that I ever saw, and I'm glad to say that she is on the I know I mentioned it before. It is so good. Anyone who has not seen it, the live taping of Rent from the stage production, not the film. Renee is in it, and Will Chase is in it, and Adam Cantor is in it, and it's really fantastic. So check that out. Jane is great, and She Loves Me. I have the contemporary problem that I have with everyone else's performance in that, but she's delightful, and her dancing is great, and she's always so incredibly charming and wonderful on stage. And I think it probably won't happen, but it would be amazing if Jennifer Simard won, not only because her performance was so wonderful, but it also, I think it's quite bracing when we see a case like that, where in a show that is generally considered not to work very well and to be basically a flop, when someone can be so great in it that they literally have the audience in the palm of their hands, and they completely transcend whatever flaws of the production or the writing or whatever. And that does not happen very often. I would have to think about the last time I've seen that, and I think it's a very unique kind of event, and I wish that she could be honored for that reason.
All right. So where are you guys going to be next Sunday?
I'll be here. Oh, is that what you mean? I'm
at the Tony Awards.
Oh, I don't think either of us will be at the Beacon because No.
It's funny. I thought you meant for the podcast. No, I go to a very wonderful party every year, and this will certainly take place again this year. So I look forward to it, and we, of course, do our own predictions, and we see who wins. I won 2 years ago, and I was so bored with winning that last year I really went out on a limb and chose, you know, all Mavericks, which I think I may very well again do this year. You know, it's sort of fun when you say, let's go and hope that this person who was wonderful but really doesn't stand a chance of winning. So I like ticking off those boxes under those dances.
It should be a non-Hamilton Tony ballot. You have to pick
Right. Well, that's called the Drama Desk Awards, I guess, when you think of it. Because
Yes.
And out of critic circle, too.
Yes. So
those are those ballots, yeah. So it's going to be very interesting to see which wins as Best Musical tonight, the Drama Desk, because none of them, of course, have the cachet of Hamilton. Some of them are certainly solid box office winners, and some are not, by the way. But anyway, I have ideas of what's going to happen, but I think predictions are very hard to make this year for the Drama Desk Best Musical. Hmm.
I want to ask the two of you for next week. Maybe next week we'll talk about it. Maybe let's pick out the cast recording of the year, because I just got the gorgeous sounding and gorgeous looking She Loves Me cast recording. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we should pick out the best cast recording of the season. Mm-hmm. So think about that for next week.
All right. I don't have that one, so you'll have to get it to me.
All right. So what I wanted to do is wrap up right now. But before we get to trivia, I want to remind you that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link. That way, every time we get a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your BlackBerry. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., Saturdays at 2 p.m., and contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today, can be found at BroadwayRadio.com as well. So, Peter, give us the answer to last week's trivia.
Yeah, only Donald Tessioni got it, and it was, there's an esteemed musical theater troupe that takes its name from a Sigmund Romberg song. What is it? Well, the show was called Marjorie, and it was from the 1924-25 season, and the 11 o'clock number was called 42nd Street Moon, and that indeed is the name of a troupe out of San Francisco that does old vintage musicals. They also did a cast recording of Something for the Boys, which is well worth hearing. Mm-hmm. So under those circumstances, I would like to say that the artistic director of 42nd Street Moon stepped down this year after a long tenure there, and I wish him well, and I wish the company well, that I hope it continues, because they're the ones who do the ones you've never heard of. So, as for this week, what is the shortest-running Broadway musical, original now, not a revival, to have two Tony winners in its leads?
All right, so if you know that information, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we will let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Oh, first line of the blues is always sung a second time. You hear me talking, Rocket? A second time. So by the time you get to the third line, you've had time to think of a rhyme.
says